some of you might have been here when we watched a talk by Bante a few weeks back. It was during Buddhist Action Month. And watched a video of Bante talking. As it happened, it was here at the Croydon Buddhist Centre many, many years ago, 1981, I think. Maybe two or three, sorry. Might not have got that right. On Buddhism, world peace and nuclear war. And at the time when we watched this talk, it was an hour and 40 minutes long. It's very long, so basically that's all we had time for in the morning. But there was so much in that talk that seemed very important to pick up on and explore further. So over the next few weeks, there are three themes that I'm drawing out from that particular talk that we're going to have a bit more time to explore in depth. And that will be interspersed with the other theme of this coming session, which will be, we're going to be exploring the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So that will be, contrasting themes. Continuing with this whole overarching theme of transforming self and world. So the three particular areas that I'm drawing out from Bante's talk, which I could have drawn quite a lot more out, but these seemed they were sort of umbrellas, really. One was about the whole area of violence and non-violence, peace, working for peace, and what that means to us individually. That's what we're going to be looking at today. And we're going to be looking at it in both theory and in practice, because there's also this peace meditation. We're going to go out and meditate in the Queen's Gardens, those of us who have the time up for it. We're demonstrating what the Buddha talked about, four sights that he saw. There are the obvious sights of suffering in the world, of death, sickness, old age. But the fourth sight is a sight that the Buddha saw of somebody practicing spiritual life, somebody offering an alternative. And all he did was he saw somebody. He didn't hear them teach. He didn't, find out what they were practicing. It was simply the sight of somebody doing something different, looking different. So, we won't be able to say very much to the passers-by, but there we'll be sitting there being an example of something different. Anyway, the other two themes that I want to draw out in coming weeks, and I can't remember when exactly, but Bante talks about the idea of objective truth as being an important precondition for understanding between people. And he also talked about living a worthwhile life, what it is to live a worthwhile life, and also meeting the fact of death. So we're looking at what is a worthwhile life and what is a worthwhile death, I suppose. So that's what we'll be drawing out. But anyway, today, I've drawn out some excerpts from Bante's talk. Actually, you could pass these around. That would be quite nice for you to take away. Just some brief extracts about this area of violence and non-violence and what it means to us. So I'm going to just read three short extracts and talk about each one, and we'll be doing some other stuff, doing some other things in the midst of our exploration. So Bante says, ever since the dawn of history, two great principles have been at work in the world: the principle of violence and the principle of non-violence, or, as we may also call it, the principle of love. The principle of violence finds expression in force and fraud, oppression, exploitation, intimidation, and blackmail. The principle of non-violence finds expression in friendliness and openness, in gentleness and helpfulness, and the giving of encouragement, sympathy, and appreciation. So far, of course, men have lived in accordance with the principle of violence. They could do this because it was possible without destroying themselves completely. But now this is no longer the case. Owing to the emergence of superpowers armed with nuclear weapons, it's now virtually impossible for us to live in accordance with the principle of violence without, sooner or later, annihilating ourselves. We are therefore faced with the necessity of either learning to live in accordance with the principle of non-violence or not living at all. That's a pretty stark way of expressing the situation, but I think it's as true nowadays as it was then. In some ways, maybe the threat of actual nuclear war has somewhat receded. I think it's something we grew up with. You know, that I certainly had nightmares about nuclear bombs dropping on my flats, you know. That's somewhat receded in a way. Superpowers have turned to more conventional weapons. But nonetheless, you know, we have a presidential candidate who talks quite, you know, he talks about using nuclear weapons. So while they're there, they're usable. Anything could happen. Anybody could get their hands on them. But, you know, it's not simply a matter of nuclear weapons. Obviously, it's a question of armaments in general. And we can engage socially in that. Recently, I decided that an organisation I wanted to support was the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, which seems to have been quite successful in lobbying to not sell arms to Saudi Arabia. They've been part of that. So we can get involved politically, and it's important that we do support such organisations. But it's also important that we look at the way in which we support them. We look at our own minds. So in a way, I want to sort of look at this area of where violence begins and where it can end. Violence begins in our own mind, and it can end, at least for us personally, in our own mind. So Banta has talked on a number of occasions about the concept of love mode and power mode. He took this particular teaching from a psychologist called Eric Fromm, who was the first one to elucidate it. And it's a very, very interesting and, well, profound teaching. In a way, it's another way of putting this teaching of violence and non-violence. Power mode and love mode. Power mode is the use of force over others in gross ways are quite obvious, and in subtle ways as well. And love mode is completely abandoning the use of power mode, not using power over others. So we're very conditioned to use power mode. It's what we grow up with to a large extent. Of course there is love in our life, but we grow up with power, we grow up with authority and structures and doing things because we're told to, you know, because we'll be punished. And so in some ways it can be very much a sort of a default way of thinking about things. If I hear somebody say something that I don't agree with, I may not punch them, okay, physically, but I can get quite, you know, internally cross and almost sort of insulted. You know, if you hear another outrageous thing that somebody's just said on the news, there is this, you know, response that, which in a way it can be quite aggressive, and it can be quite sort of attacking the person rather than the view. I don't know if you recognise that. I certainly find this. So, oh, what, you know, stupid thing to say. And actually start to think about a person in a particular way. So power mode is a kind of a conditioned response in the way that we think about people. So, I was thinking, when I was thinking about this, I just remembered a teaching from the psychologist Carl Jung, who has a lot of very, very interesting things to say about the way that we respond to others, the way what we project on others in the world. He's not so well known or current nowadays, but he talked about the idea of the shadow, the idea of that the parts of ourselves that are unacceptable to ourselves being somewhat outside of our consciousness. And when we see something like that outside in the world, we tend to kind of project that onto the external. And this is, you know, how the rise of extreme political movements and so forth are all very much to do with a more collective projection of the shadow onto those other people who are different from us. We see so much of this in the world at the moment, I think, that kind of projection onto the others who are different. He said something very interesting. He said, if you imagine someone who's brave enough to withdraw all his projections, that's to say to own all one's own shadow, to take on board that this belongs to me, it's not projected out onto somebody else, then you get an individual who is conscious of a pretty thick shadow. Okay. He is now unable to say that they do this or that, they are wrong, and they must be fought against. Such a one knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. He has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic unsolved social problems of our day. So do you get this? This is to do with, you know, taking responsibility for ourselves and our own mental states. In Bhante's terms, he would talk about it as becoming an individual, becoming somebody who is self-aware and self-responsible. And in further than that, we create spiritual community by becoming individuals, relating to other individuals. So, I've got a little exercise here. Right. What I'd like you to do is think of something that you really believe and hold. So this might be about politics, it might be about Brexit. So okay, on what, just jot down something that it's a kind of something that you do think, believe. And maybe a few reasons why you believe that. Now, imagine that you're somebody that thinks the opposite. Put yourself in that person's shoes. Why might they think that? What life experiences might have led to that? What reasonable points of view might they even have? Okay. Now, I'd like you to get partners. Right? And I want you to tell your partner that second part. Tell your partner. You're going to argue from the point of view of somebody that you don't agree with, right?
That's a good twist.
I just did it in my own mind, right? I don't agree with all that, but anyway, you know, I think what we've been exploring is the tendency that we have to polarise automatically and make other people wrong and bad. Yeah. And it's not to say that some points of view are more ethical than others. Of course, some points of view are more ethical than others. But there's something about the ability to understand why, you know, why people think the way they do or feel the way they do, mm-hmm. is the first steps into getting into dialogue and getting into, you know, the possibility of change. So this is a sort of underlying tendency in our mind to polarise. Yeah, just a couple of things that occurred to me when I was thinking about this whole area of violence and non-violence. There's a lot of violence in entertainment nowadays, and there can be a lot of discussion about whether it affects people, conditions our mind, or so forth. I mean, the teaching of Buddhism would be, of course, it does. You know, what we contemplate, we become. What we expose ourselves to becomes the habitual tendency of our mind. I did also, I was listening to a writer, Will Self, who was talking about violence in entertainment recently, and he was saying it's a question about whether it causes people to be more mentally violent. He also said, but the thing is that we almost ignore it is violence in itself, it is violence, you know. If you're exposed to that kind of input, you feel pain, you know, you feel there's a sort of response of pain and hurt and so forth. So in itself it's violence. I think that's quite an interesting point of view. So I suppose that, you know, maybe the question that there's going to be a little bit of time to get into groups and talk about some questions. So maybe the first question I'd like to ask in relation to this is, well, when do I polarise most? What are the areas where I'm most tend to think I'm right and other people are wrong? In a kind of self-righteous way. So, second excerpt that I wanted to read from Sangharakshita's talk is a basic assumption, he says. Now, what I have said on the subject of Buddhism, world peace and nuclear war, as well as what I'm going to say, all rests on a single assumption. Some people would regard it as a very big assumption indeed, but nevertheless hope it is an assumption you share with me. The assumption to which I refer is that nuclear war is not inevitable. It is the assumption that nuclear weapons can be abolished and world peace achieved. If that was not my assumption, I would not be wasting my time and yours by talking to you this evening. Admittedly, the risk of nuclear war is very great. Admittedly, world peace is very difficult to achieve. But as we contemplate the possibility of nuclear holocaust, we should not allow the sheer horror of the prospect to reduce us to inaction like frightened rabbits, mesmerized into immobility by the headlights of an approaching car. Buddhism believes that ills created by man and many not created by man can be remedied by man. This does not mean that it underestimates the difficulties involved. So, this is an assumption, and I just like to kind of, you know, do we share that assumption or not? How do we feel in response to that statement?
Yes.
You do. With difficulty?
Great difficulty.
With great difficulty.
Great difficulty.
With great difficulty. With great difficulty. So that means that we have, there's a possibility of people changing their positions and changing their minds. You know, I think for me, I believe it's possible. I also see that it's very, very difficult. I think that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think, this thing that Obama has said about how being part of the movement towards something is a valid kind of, you might not see the result that you wish, but you can be part of the movement towards something. And for example, nowadays we don't have slavery, and we don't have, in some countries, capital punishment. 60,000 people died on the first day of the Somme. We wouldn't do that now, not in this country. Some might, but we wouldn't. You know, that you can look around and see that change happens, and it can happen in certain directions. And at the same time, there's this kind of basic kind of, I suppose the Buddha taught that samsara is, in a sense, it goes on forever. You know, the in a way, the movement towards enlightenment is an individual affair. Individuals can affect society, but we in a way can't kind of dream of a perfect society when we're all beings are enlightened, unless we're making a personal effort to grow and develop. So I suppose something to look at in relation to this is, what's our default position in relation to being optimistic or being pessimistic? You know, do we tend to just automatically be optimistic or automatically pessimistic? You know, so that's something to think about. Buddhism, Bhante has said that Buddhism is neither optimistic nor pessimistic, but it's melioristic, which is a nice word. It means things can get better. They might be bad, but they can get better. So just something to think about. And the third extract is this: above all, teaching the Metta Bhavana. Above all, we can teach people to practice the Metta Bhavana, or the development of universal friendliness. A traditional Buddhist method of developing an increasingly positive attitude towards all other living beings, including those persons with whom ordinarily we do not get on with very well, or we may dislike or even hate. It is one of the fundamental postulates of Buddhism that the individual is responsible for his own mental and emotional states. This means he can change those states, provided he really wants to do so, and provided he knows the right way to go about it. If people were to take up the practice of Metta Bhavana in sufficiently large numbers, it could result in the more development of a more positive attitude towards other national communities, not only on the part of private citizens, but on the part of governments too. And this would undoubtedly contribute to the reduction of international tension, and thereby to the eventual abolition of nuclear weapons. Those of us who are Buddhists should perhaps give serious consideration to the possibility of our teaching the Metta Bhavana on a nationwide scale. Mm. Our experience is that metta is transformative. So that prospect of the Metta Bhavana being taught widely, I was really thrilled. I was you can tell probably when I talk that I listen to Radio 4 quite a lot. I turned on the radio and somebody was talking about metta, and was using that word, metta, and was describing the stages of the Metta Bhavana, which it was a programme called Beyond Belief. They were talking about forgiveness and trauma and how to go about it. And though I mentioned this on the Tuesday class, so apologies if you were there. There was a woman being interviewed who had something absolutely horrendous happen in her past, in her family. And she had decided right from the very start that she had to find a way to forgive, because she didn't want her whole life to be determined by this single event. But it took her 20 years. And she went on retreat, she went on Buddhist retreat, she learnt the Metta Bhavana. And after 20 years, she was able to do an act of forgiveness, to write a letter of forgiveness very, very sincerely. It took 20 years. And in a way, this is the kind of level at which eventually we need to find a way of working. The level of forgiving what seems to be the unforgivable. Because violence is a cycle. It's a cycle of action, hurt, revenge. Hurt, revenge. Hurt, revenge. And that needs to stop somewhere. It has to stop within our own minds. So, but not to underestimate how difficult that is. And this is why the Metta Bhavana is so vital and transformative, where we're just meeting that fourth stage, you know, that person that maybe just gets on the nerves a bit, you know. But gradually developing that capacity to forgive, you know, in greater and greater and greater ways. So just imagining a society where a lot of people did do the Metta Bhavana. I mean, it is something, you know, we experience the effects of metta in ourselves, in our lives, and we are quite ordinary people. We're not particularly special, but we do create an atmosphere of positivity and sangha through Metta Bhavana. And it's not, I think, an inconceivable prospect that the Metta Bhavana should be as well known as mindfulness. Gradually, it is filtering out. They mostly call it compassion meditation, but it is something which is happening, and I think that's a source of hope. I think a great source of hope. So I think this is the third question to just look at collectively. Well, in what way have I experienced metta that's transformative? And, you know, maybe just to sort of finish what I'm saying, I think that this is the big contribution that we have to make as Buddhists. It's the teaching of mindfulness, sure. Metta Bhavana, you know, contribution to society is something that we can make. It's something that we just keep doing every week, week in, week out. Well, some weeks mindfulness, some weeks metta. But just sending out that kind of pulse of the heartbeat of metta into the world every week to whoever wants to learn it is, I think, a huge contribution to me. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha.
Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Shakya Muni Swaha. Mahamudra.